Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, just how much does the U.S. military pollute the environment? What is its role in climate change causing greenhouse gas emissions? Our next three guests have been measuring this impact. With us is Nita Crawford. She is professor of political science and department chair at Boston University and the author of the book, Accountability for Killing, Moral Responsibility for Collateral Damage in America's Post-9/11 Wars, and the research paper, Pentagon Fuel Use, Climate Change and the Costs of War. Benjamin Nymark also joins us. He is senior lecturer at the University of Lancaster in the UK and author of Speaking Power to Post-Truth, Critical Political Ecology and the New Authoritarianism. Oliver Belcher joins us. He's assistant professor in human geography at Durham University and author of Anatomy of a Village Raising, Counterinsurgency, Violence, and Securing the Intimate in Afghanistan. Nymark and Belcher also co-authored Hidden Carbon Costs of the Everywhere War, Logistics, Geopolitical Ecology, and the Carbon Bootprint of the U.S. Military. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It is great to have the three of you with us. Fascinating studies about, especially as we're talking about climate change and what we're facing as a humanity, as a planet, and the role of the military, which hasn't been looked at very closely. I thought perhaps Ben Nymark, Oliver Belcher, you've co-authored this piece. That's what prompted me to want to do this. I thought we would start with your study and kind of how you came to the study and how you conducted it. Ben, do you want to start and then Oliver continue and then we'll bring in Nita?
Sure. The approach to the study really came from a general interest from all of us, sort of conversations we've been having about previous research we've done and just sort of what we saw as a general lack of any independent studies on U.S. military greenhouse gas emissions, something we call the carbon footprint or the carbon bootprint, as we've termed it. And we just started to dig in and realized that there were not many sort of independent studies out there that we could find. There were a number of Department of Defense studies and a few other studies on the costs of war, which is Roger, one of the scientists here, but nothing published particularly in geography journals, which we were interested in exploring.
And Oliver, what would you add to this? Like, how did you actually get the data? How did you crunch the data? How did you make sense of the data?
Well, I think originally what we were trying to do was produce a kind of carbon emissions study of the U.S. military. But what we found very quickly was it was difficult to get reliable data on those figures. I think Nita and Ben will have more to say about this than I will, but I, there's very sparse reporting on the kind of U.S. military's hydrocarbon use and their emissions generally. And so what we did, we kind of took some routes looking at the Department of Energy, other agencies, and we ended up in the course of our work coming across a massive bureaucratic agency called the Defense Logistics Agency. And what this agency does, what they're tasked with is essentially delivering all sorts of goods and material to the U.S. military on all its bases and missions around the world. Those can be humanitarian missions, humanitarian aid, to food, to different bases, to weapons and hydrocarbons. And we became particularly interested in a sub-agency within the Defense Logistics Agency called the DLAE, Defense Logistics Agency Energy sub-agency, which was tasked with just providing hydrocarbons to the four branches of the U.S. military. So we produced a series of, wrote a series of Freedom of Information Act requests, submitted those, and got back a pretty extensive data set on the purchases made by the U.S. military of various sorts of fuels, ranging from warships to fighter jets to land vehicles to tanks, what have you, and that show those receipts and the distribution of those hydrocarbons across the world and within the United States and across the world. And what's significant about the agency is that it's sort of a one-stop shop for hydrocarbon purchases within the U.S. military. So that's more or less how we came to the kind of basis for our study, which looked at the supply chains that supply hydrocarbons to various parts of the U.S. military, both domestically in the United States and across the world.
And Nita Crawford, you also have studied the impact of the military on the environment, particularly climate change. How did your study compare to Ben's and Oliver's?
Well, I had no idea that they were doing their work. And I independently, because of a class that I was teaching last fall, needed to understand the way that the Pentagon was thinking about both the problem of climate change and their responses to it, in particular what they saw as their vulnerabilities. And so I went to try to find a number, any number that would give me an indication of the scale of the Pentagon's contribution to global greenhouse gases. And there wasn't one. There were numbers for, you know, short time periods or 1 year. You could, you know, find information sort of scattered, but there was no comprehensive database. And so what I did was I went to the Department of Energy and I used their data because the Department of Defense explicitly does not release to Congress its fuel consumption. And that's the same thing that the other scholars ran into. So I had to use a proxy number, which is the Department of Energy's information. So I got that data from 1975 to 2017, the most recent year. And then I had to convert U.S. energy use into the components of greenhouse gas emitters like petroleum, jet fuel, propane, diesel, gas, and then do a calculation adding those things up. And that's what I did. I looked at standard emissions and non-standard emissions, that is warfare-related emissions, and I just did the math for that.
That's just remarkable that you guys did that. And also what I thought was remarkable from doing reading of your work is up until now, when we measure climate emissions, say, that a country emits, it sounded like what you all have said is that it's been left out. The military's emissions have been left out when we calculate how much a country emits.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. has never, you know, it never had to report for any particular reason. First of all, for a long time, it was never asked, I don't believe. And then when conversations started to sort of bubble up right around the Kyoto Protocol, my understanding was it wanted an opt-out from having to fully report on its greenhouse gas emissions. And then this was sort of, I guess, reported that it was doubly locked, they say, by an authorization bill in the late 90s, sort of by the House of Representatives, meaning they never had to then, by any means, voluntarily report their greenhouse gas emissions. And then under the Paris Agreement, the military wasn't even in the conversation. And, you know, I think that's just remarkable. And in our sort of preliminary research, we started coming across different reports, but not many, as you would imagine, that were questioning why the U.S. military just wasn't, being the largest hydrocarbon consumer in the world, was just never really asked.
So let's talk about some of those numbers now. I mean, the one that was sort of the headline grabber, Ben, was that, you know, the military is, its pollution is bigger than some 140 countries.
Right. These are the sort of headline grabbing numbers that sort of came out. I think what was remarkable that independently, both Nita's study and ours came up with fairly similar, you know, data, right? The positioning of the U.S. military comparable to medium-sized countries. I think we were just a couple countries off, no, Nita?
That's right.
I mean, that's pretty, it made us feel pretty good, actually, that our data was verified through an independent study that, you know, really placed us against. I think it positioned us, we were 47th largest emitter, and between Peru and Portugal, and I believe, if I'm correct, your study was very close to Sweden?
Larger than Sweden or Denmark. But I think what's interesting here is when you look at it over the long run, U.S. fuel consumption, as you said, was exempted from the Kyoto Protocol. That is, anything to do with bunker fuels or war. And it's not just the U.S. military who won that exemption from counting at the Kyoto Protocol negotiations. It's every country in the world. But of course, because the United States military is by far the largest military in the world with bases all over, its greenhouse gas emissions are the ones that we really need to pay attention to. And as you said, they're larger than many countries, in fact, most countries in the world. And because my study goes from 1975 to 2017, what I can show is that because U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, that is by the military, have gone down gradually, other countries have gone up, its position has changed. At the beginning of my study in 1975, it was in the top 25 emitters. But because China and other Asian tigers started using more fuel, and the U.S. military gradually decreased its greenhouse gas emissions by decreasing fuel consumption, it has dropped in the rankings. But it is still an enormous emitter, larger than most countries.
So I really do want to get into how the changes have occurred and the trends and what that really means and if it's meaningful and the contradiction that I think that Oliver and Ben have written about as well. Before we go there, one of the things I wanted to do was understand all of the ways in which the U.S. military is a top polluter and a large emitter of greenhouse gases. So, Nita, you talked about aircraft, you talked about B-2 stealth bombers, you gave us some number breakdowns in your paper. Can you walk us through some of those?
Sure. There are a couple ways to think about it. One is the big picture of the way the Pentagon thinks about it, which is installation fuel use versus operational use. And when you think about installations, that's about 30% of the consumption. That's bases and buildings. Like, for instance, the Pentagon is the largest building in the world, office building in the world, and it by itself consumes quite a bit of fuel just to heat and cool it. But then you look at the operational side, which includes the transportation of troops, the running of tanks and aircraft, even refueling vehicles like tankers, which themselves require fuel to refuel the B-2 bombers and the fighter bombers. What you see is that each one of these is a large consumer. So the operational side is about 70%. And if you, for example, think about this in terms of, let's say, Air Force versus Navy versus Army versus Marines, the Air Force by itself is the single largest consumer. And then of all of the consumption, it's jet fuel, which is from 1975 to 2017, the major source of emissions.
Can you give us some numbers that might make sense to us, like some comparative numbers that would give us a sense of what scope we're talking about?
Well, I have a Toyota Prius. It gets about 50 miles per gallon. A B-2 bomber gets about 4.2 gallons per mile. Or the new F-35 gets about 2.37 gallons per mile. The best vehicle that I talk about here is the Hummer, the Humvee. That gets about, I think, 8 miles per gallon. We're talking, you know, enormously thirsty machines. And then in terms of comparing, let's say, to sectors of the economy, I think that when I was trying to get, you know, just a sense in any one year, what would be a comparable industry, all of the, I think it's steel production in the United States, would be comparable to that, any one year's consumption and emissions by the U.S. military. So it's really hard to get one's head around because it is so enormous. Now, but when you think about it in terms of the entire U.S. economy, It seems, however, that it's not as large. But you have to also understand that it's about between 77 and 82% of all U.S. government emissions, all the military emissions, in other words, comprise the bulk of U.S. government emissions.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we are talking about the environmental impact of military operations.
I'm just looking at some of the numbers that I pulled out of one of your papers. And this is from your paper, for example, the B-2 stealth bomber, which holds more than 25,600 gallons of jet fuel, burns 4.28 gallons per mile, and emits more than 250 metric tons of greenhouse gas over 6,000 nautical mile range. Can you help us understand that in layperson's term?
So if the United States wants to take a B-2 from the middle of the country in Missouri to somewhere in the Middle East, it's got to put up about 12 tankers to make sure that it makes it there with adequate fuel and comes back and can perform its mission. And those tankers themselves get about 2.9 or 3 gallons per mile. So in any one mission, let's say it's a 12 or 14,000 mile mission, it's itself putting up about 500 metric tons. And then it will not go alone. As I said, it will go with these tankers, the KC-135 or the KC-46 tanker, and they will be flying about preparing to refuel this plane when it needs more fuel. So any one mission is quite fuel intensive.
Oliver, what would you add to this? You looked in these path dependencies. How does this compare to what Nita is telling us?
Oh, I think it's very important. You were speaking earlier about reporting, which is kind of looking at, you know, the past and you know, to what extent the U.S. military complied or didn't comply with stating its emissions reduction. But what path dependencies, what that emphasizes is really the future-oriented aspect of these weapon systems, or as Nita was speaking to, the installations that the U.S. military builds and uses for years to come. And what's significant about those is that it locks in the U.S. military to hydrocarbon use for a generation or two of these particular weapon systems. So you might, for example, look at the new F-35 program, which has been a controversial jet fighter program, but has also been a lot of investment in that program for a decade now. And the U.S. military is selling that jet around the world to various militaries. And what that does is it locks in not only the U.S. military to a weapon system that consumes vast amounts of hydrocarbons in its own right. Jet fuels, as Nita mentioned, and as we show in our study, are the biggest culprit for greenhouse gas emissions. But other militaries who buy that weapon system, buy the F-35, are also locked in to that particular hydrocarbon use. And so those path dependencies are very important to consider if we're thinking about how to actually mitigate or tackle this problem in the near term and the long term, and thinking about, you know, what kind of priorities are being set within the military for particular weapon systems or installations that use these fuels over the long durée.
It sounds like what you're also saying is not only does it lock us into these weapon systems, it also locks us into a particular economy.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, and I think that the big kind of questions now that are circulating about how to transform an economy or pivot an economy away from a hydrocarbon fuel-based economy to something else, at least within the United States. I mean, you can't talk about that seriously without talking about the U.S. military as the largest institutional actor, environmental actor within the U.S.
Ben Nymark, what would you add to this?
There's a few things here, of course. As Oliver just mentioned, the U.S. military is seen as many things, but it's sometimes called out for its environmental record, usually in terms of it's sort of in Vieques, Puerto Rico, we hear a lot about sort of around testing of bombs and military base sort of pollution and other things. But we rarely talk about it as a sort of climate polluter, as an large environmental actor. Most focus is on civilian use of fuel consumption or civilian large multinational company sort of use of hydrocarbon. And so we're trying to sort of turn that gaze on the U.S. military as a environmental actor. But it's, of course, as we mentioned, it's also an economic actor. It's by far one of the largest sort of economic actor. It moves markets, as one of the co-authors and I wrote about in a previous paper. It's used to of drop in biofuels for its Great Green Fleet. It was a U.S. Navy initiative to sort of turn its fleet green. And we demonstrated that it actually moved biofuel markets in places like Southern California. I mean, there was an incredible sort of logistical infrastructure built to literally move biofuels from where they were being processed to fuel these ships, the Great Green Fleet. So it's really important to think about the U.S. military as a as many things. One, as an environmental actor, but for sure as a political, economic, or economic actor as well. As also Oliver mentioned, and I think Nita was speaking of as well, we need to think about the fuel supply chains. I mean, it's one of the things we bring out in our paper is kind of not just the hidden aspects of U.S. military and its lack of carbon accounting, but also how it, I guess you could say, its fuel tentacles allow it to reach all corners of the globe to in its forward operating bases, but also in its different tactical sort of maneuvering. It now is able to conduct military operations anywhere in the globe. And that's because of its global hydrocarbon supply chain.
Oliver, I would just add to that, you know, we often hear about how there is, you know, a massive kind of base that U.S. military bases are apparently over 700 military bases around the world. Right. And you have to think about once you begin to think about that material infrastructure, you have to think about all of those supply chains that supply those bases, you know, all 700, not including the ones that are in the United States, the little, you know, places where National Guard train on the weekends. So there are, you know, once you begin to think about that sprawling base infrastructure, you can begin to appreciate the flows, the hydrocarbon flows that are necessary to fuel those bases, not including the vehicles, you know, those installations themselves, to get the kind of scope of use just on a daily basis.
When we come back, what are some of the hidden environmental costs of military operations and what could be done to reduce those impacts? Stay tuned.
Conservationist Rachel Carson.
Like the sea itself, the shore fascinates us who return to it, the place of our dim ancestral beginnings. In the recurrent rhythms of tide and surf, and in the varied life of the tide lines, there is the obvious attraction of movement and change and beauty. There is also, I am convinced, a deeper fascination born of inner meaning and significance. When we go down to the low tide line, we enter a world that is as old as the earth itself, the primeval meeting place of the elements of earth and water, a place of compromise and conflict and eternal change. For us as living creatures, it has special meaning as an area in or near which some entity that could be distinguished as life first drifted in shallow waters, reproducing, evolving, yielding that endlessly varied stream of living things that has surged through time and space to occupy the Earth.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The U.S. military has taken some measure to reduce its impact on the environment and on its greenhouse gas emissions, but our guests say that these measures do little to assuage the military's bigger effects on climate change. What are some of these effects and what can be done about them? With us is Nita Crawford. She is professor of political science and department chair at Boston University and the author of the research paper, Pentagon Fuel Use, Climate Change and the Costs of War. Benjamin Nymark also joins us. He is senior lecturer at the University of Lancaster in the UK. Oliver Belcher joins us. He's assistant professor in human geography at Durham University. Nymark and Belcher co-authored Hidden Carbon Costs of the Everywhere War, Logistics, Geopolitical Ecology, and the Carbon Bootprint of the U.S. Military. Both papers have written about the idea of either, in Nita's language, it was continuous war since 2001. And Oliver and Ben, in your paper, you talked about everywhere war. So is this kind of interconnected with the environmental impact?
Well, that's my argument, yes. I think that when you think about this 17 and a half years of continuous war by the United States, and you just look at the period from 2001 to 2017, what you see is that about 400 million metric tons, more than 400 million metric tons, has been associated with the fighting of these wars themselves, just in terms of fossil fuel consumption and greenhouse gas emissions. And that's just the fighting of it. And then you add the installations, which, as was mentioned, are essential to support the fighting. But I wanted to actually go back and connect to something else that was said about the nature of the situation here. It's not just that the United States has the world's largest military, spends more than its adversaries combined, and has the capacity to intervene anywhere. It's that it uses greenhouse gas emitting ships to patrol access to fuel. So to protect the United States' access to fuel and other countries' access to fuel. And, for example, we have about one, or depending on the situation, sometimes two aircraft carriers patrolling the Persian Gulf, okay, and available to intervene to protect access to oil. At the same time, that global, and especially the United States' necessity to have that oil has actually declined because of, for example, other sources of fossil fuels from Canada and elsewhere, and in addition, reductions in the need, that is, greater renewable energy. So what we're doing is we're spending fuel, consuming it to protect oil, that, and without actually rethinking that mission. And so the circular nature of that has not been part of the Pentagon calculation. Then the other thing that's interesting here is the Pentagon's increased concern about what they call climate wars, but, or climate conflict. I don't know that war is a necessary response to climate catastrophe, but it may be. But in any case, the military really worries about that, but they don't connect it to their own contribution to the problem. Instead, they're worried about their bases.
It's interesting you say that. I know from my days as an environmental commissioner in Los Angeles about this concern that the military had. They came and actually testified in front of our commission about what climate change really means in terms of conflict. And there have been some studies in political science about how climate change correlates with more violence. And of course, the effects that it has on resources, water, droughts, food, which can fuel conflict as well. But so there are all of these interrelationships. And what sounds like what you guys are all saying is, well, yes, they're expressing their concern about this on one hand and trying to do a little bit of greening. Nita, you talked about that in your paper, like how they've decreased some of their emissions over the trend. But perhaps it's a little bit paradoxical.
It's ironic, and actually what they're doing is counterproductive. Now, they're making the problem worse, the thing that they fear. I think that one of the reasons why that hasn't been acknowledged is the sort of allergy in this administration, but also in previous administrations, to admit that climate change is human caused and that burning fossil fuels is the cause of it. But I also think that there is little incentive to really rethink U.S. foreign policy if what you've got is an entire economy that believes it is dependent on fossil fuels. But as we move away from that, as we create an economy based on other things, I think that the renewable energy, that is, you could see that there's an opening to rethink U.S. foreign policy. But these things have to go hand in hand. We have to be willing to say that we'll accept a little bit more vulnerability in the world to help make sure that the worst things don't happen.
You know, Ben and Oliver have also written about a little of this as well, like sort of the contradictory nature of this. So, Oliver, perhaps you can start, Ben could come in, about how, yes, there's this investment in fossil fuel delivery infrastructures, and then the renewables and alternative fuels, there was a little bit of movement toward them, but then you said they've been dropping out of the documents. So how do you see what's going on here?
Well, I think Ben has written about this more than I have, so he probably have more to say. But, you know, having been studying the U.S. military now for over a decade pretty intensely, I mean, there's been several instances where the U.S. military has, unlike Republican administrations, has acknowledged that climate change is a human-made problem and has begun to rethink strategic orientation in various parts of the world around a changing climate. I used to live in Finland, and one of the I was there for 5 years, and during that time, one of the big geopolitical question marks in Finland and the surrounding area was, you know, what's going to be the status of the Arctic once the ice cap melts? And the U.S. military, along with Canada and Norway, the United Kingdom, Russia, have Sweden, of course, have all been thinking or have been strategically orienting themselves to these new channels that are opening within the melting Arctic, where there just weren't navigation paths before. And so what you see is, on the one hand, an acknowledgement of human man-made climate change, of global warming, and how that's creating the conditions for new types of global warming around places where you have jockeying for a geostrategic position. But the way to get there, as Nita was just saying, was by relying on weapon systems and vehicles and all sorts of weaponry that are reliant on fossil fuels themselves, that are kind of creating this feedback loop. So you have a farcical scenario in a way that it's hard to see, you know, what direction that's going to go through without a grassroots movement in those countries that begin to reignite critical questions about the U.S. military and its role around the world.
Ben Nymark?
As we mentioned, the American military sort of climate policy remains fundamentally contradictory. There's been these sort of, I guess one might call it, half-hearted attempts to sort of green certain aspects of its bases. And as we mentioned, the Great Green Fleet, which was probably the largest initiative in the early 2000s to sort of demonstrate a particular type of green military. But it's fundamentally contradictory, right? Because you're seeing, as both Nita and Oliver mentioned, there's just a sort of number of countermeasures done to sort of ensure that hydrocarbons are protected, that they keep flowing, and that we build particular hardware that is dependent on these fuel sources. But it would be shrewd not to sort of call out the fact that climate change, although can be linked, and I want to be careful not to sort of draw a direct causal link to conflict and climate change, although for sure there's evidence to show that there's been some, there are connections between sort of conflict and environmental change, that it presents an opportunity for the U.S. military. There's now, they'll be called upon to be sort of the humanitarian force that comes in and now directs missions to in flood-prone areas and also to be on the front lines of different and new opportunities to use different parts of their hardware and sort of show a sort of soft power abroad through new humanitarian crises that will come through climate change-induced effects. I guess having said that, there needs to be a way in which to see this. And I think what we were talking about before, in particular certain lock-ins, this is a really, I wonder, and Oliver and I have been talking about this quite a bit with Patrick, about whether or not the one of the reasons why we don't call out the U.S. military is because we just don't see it beyond the sort of political buy-in, but it just seems like an intractable problem that is too big. And thus, why don't we sort of try to tinker around the edges? And we're arguing that, no, it's not too big. It's extremely important that we start conducting research, we independent research, and that we start to look at the military as a critical environmental and climate actor. And saying that, and one of the things that I think we also have been speaking about is, and Oliver just sort of alluded to it, is how does papers and our publications get used and transform into what might be street politics or resistance to climate change or such large institutions. And sort of what we, you know, I don't think we've seen sort of anti-war environmental activism since, you know, what I think the last time we saw such mass mobilization was against sort of nuclear testing in the 1970s and 80s. And so I think, I think what we would really be looking for is a sort of similar type of coalition politics that might come out of this work that would resist against what we see as the U.S. military as such a large climate actor.
Well, Ben, with you saying that and with you writing a little bit about how to address the post-truth era where, you know, a big chunk of Americans, including highly educated ones, deny the connection between carbon emissions and climate change. I mean, how do you even envision something like that in this environment?
Yeah, it's a great question, right? And so, you know, already we're starting to see some of it's been a hot button topic on the campaign trail, right? So Warren has already mentioned that we need to call out the U.S. military, its potential for initiatives like the Green New Deal, although every New Deal needs a bit of tweaking. I think potentially having something in there that would address mass mobilization against, sort of some sort of anti-war activism might find its way in some sort of coalition politics. I think, you know, we need to support what I would argue, we need to support, student protests that have been taking place across, started here in Europe, but also now going global, right? We need to really get that conversation going with sort of the youth and in support of, again, street politics around this.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we are talking about the environmental impact of military operations.
Nita, you're a political scientist. What do you say to this?
Well, there's so many threads here. I want to just go back to the connection to war, and then I want to talk about a few other things. But in particular, there are things that I did not calculate in my paper. And one of them are the war-related emissions that have to do when the United States and, let's say, ISIS or Iraq have targeted oil infrastructure. And oil infrastructure has been targeted in the most recent wars, including in the U.S. war against ISIS in Iraq and Syria most recently. So there are other ways that the military contributes massively to greenhouse gas emissions. We have to question whether or not the long-term value of taking a particular piece of territory is worth the emissions of starting these oil well fires, or which go on for months and sometimes longer than a year, or fires at refineries. There are other, of course, economic and environmental costs of targeting oil infrastructure, but that's just one. But then the connection to conflict in another way is that, yes, it's not necessarily the case that war will happen because people are feeling extreme temperatures, are on the move, migrating, or because they lack access to safe drinking water. But we need to be aware that tensions will rise in the world. Now, the response cannot be to then say that it's a military response. There are other things to do, and I think we need to think more carefully about that. The U.S. military, however, is looking essentially at the ways that they need to be prepared militarily. As far as other things, I want to think about some of the other things you said, Ben, about the Green New Deal and so on. Elizabeth Warren's plan that she put in a resolution with a member of Congress was actually about not reducing greenhouse gases, but essentially about monitoring the military's response and about decreasing the military's vulnerability. It could have been a much more ambitious proposal. And I think she can be pushed there. Congressman Ro Khanna of California has staff members who are interested in much more robust congressional action on this score. I think that the fact that several United States candidates for president at the Democratic debates on the first night raised climate as the number one problem was a significant change over past election cycles. And then finally, I want to think about decreasing consumption, because really that's what we need. We need to move away from consuming this much fuel to have a military be able to do everything everywhere all the time. And one way to do that, I think, is to actually push for more transparency about how they use their fuel. And then we might actually see what portion, we still don't actually know, what portion of all these, for instance, of jet fuel consumption is actually for training that may or may not be necessary, or for air shows that may or may not be necessary. In other words, you know, that transparency will help us, I think, make changes on the margin. But the military itself has made changes that have been quite significant, and not just because they want to be green in appearance, greenwashing, but because they want to be less vulnerable in the field when they don't require as much oil to be transported. And they want to have lower bills. And they realized that if you want to spend your money fighting rather than paying for oil, you should green up your military. So it's not just the greenwashing aspect. So I think there's a lot of ways to get at this problem. I don't know that the movement in the streets going to come from this. I think a movement in the streets will come from other things, but this has to be part of the solution.
Can I say one thing about the climate politics dimension?
Yes, please.
This is Oliver Belcher. As you might have seen here in the UK and across Europe, there has been a massive movement that's emerged called Extinction Rebellion, which as a youth movement, basically, of people who are very worried about how human-induced climate change is affecting basically the conditions for life on Earth. And but one of the even though I'm a fellow traveler with that movement, I think that the language that's being circulated has to be, we have to be very careful when we're thinking about this dimension of the military. And you might have seen that here in the UK, in The Guardian and a couple other print publications online, there's been a large adoption of this use of words like climate crisis and climate emergency. And while I agree with the sentiment and principle that frames that discussion, I think that we have to be wary a little bit about that kind of language, or at least think about it, how we use it. Because I frequently tell my students, I teach a whole lecture block at Durham University called The Climate Crisis. And I start the course with a discussion about during the 2012 climate summit meeting. There, I happened to be listening to Canadian broadcasting company, the CBC, on the proceedings that were happening. And one of the guests on there was asked a question by a reporter of, you know, what do you think the chances are of humanity making it into the next century? And the response of the commentator and climate scientist was 50-50. You know, 50-50 for humanity making it the next century. I mean, this is whether or not that figure is true or not. What the problem that it poses is a question of how we approach that issue politically. And we're in a situation now where democracies, at least if you listen to the rhetoric, are more fragile than ever before. But democracy is a deliberative exercise, right? I mean, as we've learned here with Brexit, it requires time, it requires patience. And if you're committed to democracy, you can't have rash sort of decisions that are put in place to address any sort of problem. But you have this massive global climate change problem that is effectively shifting the sands beneath our feet. And you have this tension at work where our political institutions may not be aligned to deal with this particular problem that poses potentially a massive problem for not only my children, but for my potential grandchildren in the future. And so when you use words like climate change or climate emergency and climate crisis, what you're evoking there is a state of emergency, which is not a democratic exercise, right? That is something that requires a different type of power to address things, right? And where militaries are there at the forefront of combating those ensuring order in states of emergency. So I think that we need to think about how the kind of language that we're using to talk about this problem, if we're going to be thinking about a climate politics for the near term, because certain terms have connotations that don't necessarily have a fidelity to the democratic enterprise that I'm assuming we're still committed to at the moment.
Ben Nymark?
Yeah, just to turn back on that, I think that's a really important point. When we're thinking about just ourselves, and this just does seem like such a massive thing to take on, right? I mean, it just seems there's, you know, okay, it's one thing to talk about reduction of our meat consumption, a reduction of our individual sort of the number of flights we take. But then when we start thinking about how do we crack the U.S. military here? I mean, if anything, I think that's where the conversation needs to start. If we don't start thinking about it, what we really need is to begin with is ultimate transparency here. We need to be pushing for it and demanding it. And because the more and more we see, I mean, we already look at the U.S. military, like it or not, as a trendsetter, as an innovator, right? I mean, how many times do we hear someone say the best and amazing inventions come out of war? More specifically, because the U.S. military has privileged access to space and nature and oodles of money. And so at one level, of course, they're going to be able to sort of move forward in the direction that suits them best. But I agree that transparency, and once we start to sort of peel away the layers of how the military, I mean, how can it be that the military buys and consumes just that much hydrocarbons, right? I mean, once we start to sort of look at the numbers and then we start to peel away the layers and start to see sort of its supply chains and its fueling operations and the other things, I think we're going to start to figure out, as we say, kind of being able to turn off the furnace by cranking up the heat on the U.S. military, right? It's sort of an apt way of thinking about that. I agree with Nita. I think that the U.S. military is, or any military, is going to start looking at the way in which it operates and start to think about its budget sheet. And, you know, if we present them with particular options by in which they might make choices that they will be kind of forced to make or they choose to make, we can start to sort of really make a difference here. I mean, having an optimistic bias, but I really think this is the start of something that both Nita's paper and our paper and hopefully more research in the future that will start to sort of demand such transparency. And if we don't get it, then we'll have to start to study it without sort of self-reporting in other ways.
Final thoughts, Nita Crawford.
I think that it is right to be wary of the militarization of climate change and then have a militarized response. But it is also right to feel extremely urgent about taking action immediately. There are ways that the U.S. military has reduced its consumption and could further reduce its consumption of fossil fuels. There are plenty of ideas on that. But I also don't want to dismiss something like decreasing meat consumption or planting trees, you know, very effective ways to reduce methane and to sequester carbon. And but just focusing on the military, let's say we did make it possible to close some bases or to convert them into renewable energy sites for wind and solar. And we planted trees in those bases. The military or the former bases could be an important part of the solution. And that's what I think we need to see, not militarization. Militarization, by the way, is the enemy of democracy. And that's what I think we're all in favor of. I agree with Oliver and Ben on that.
Any other burning comments before we conclude?
I'd just like to say thank you. I mean, this has been, you know, I think one of the first conversations since these papers have been published where we've all gotten together to really share our thoughts about this. I really appreciate the topic, and I think it's an extremely important topic, as you said, as we've all kind of alluded to, and I want to be hopeful moving forward.
Yeah, thank you all go ahead, Nita.
I do have one thing I wanted to say about defense industries, which we didn't talk about. One of the things that I liked about Oliver and Ben and also Patrick and the other authors' paper was they're sort of linking it to the larger supply chain. But part of the supply chain is the fact that 15% of all U.S. industry is about production of equipment and weapons for the military. It's the military-industrial part of the economy. So we just have hit the tip of the iceberg when we talk about what the Pentagon is producing. If you look at 15% of the United States industrial economy, that's a lot of emissions. So if we begin to restructure United States military so it's not patrolling everywhere all the time, reduce the size of its bases, we will actually reduce the requirement for the military to purchase these weapons. And in fact, those military industrial sectors can move on to producing other things, and then which are actually less greenhouse gas intensive, and that I think has a positive effect. That in other words, there's much more to this story, and many more positive things that we can be doing if we focus on just the United States military and its greenhouse gas emissions.
I want to thank the three of you both for your research, your foresight in doing this research, and for your willingness to share it with us and our audiences on the Scholar Circle. Thank you so very much. It's been a real pleasure to host you.
Thank you, Maria.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks, Tita and Albert.
Yeah, you too.
Nita Crawford is professor of political science and department chair at Boston University and the author of the book, Accountability for Killing, Moral Responsibility for Collateral Damage in America's Post-9/11 Wars, and the research paper, Pentagon Fuel Use, Climate Change and the Costs of War. Benjamin Nymark is senior lecturer at the University of Lancaster in the UK and author of Speaking Power to Post-Truth, Critical Political Ecology and the New Authoritarianism. Oliver Belcher is assistant professor in human geography at Durham University and author of Anatomy of a Village Raising, Counterinsurgency, Violence, and Securing the Intimate in Afghanistan. Nymark and Belcher also co-authored Hidden Carbon Costs of the Everywhere War, Logistics, Geopolitical Ecology, and the Carbon Bootprint of the U.S. Military.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible.
To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at @Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
To understand the shore, it is not enough to catalog its life. Understanding comes only when, standing on a beach, we can sense the long rhythms of earth and sea that sculptured its landform and produced the rock and sand of which it is composed. When we can sense with the eye and ear of the mind the surge of life beating always at its shores, blindly, inexorably, pressing for a foothold. To understand the life of the shore, it is not enough to pick up an empty shell and say, "This is a murex," or "That is an angel wing." True understanding demands intuitive comprehension of the whole life of the creature that once inhabited this empty shell. How it survived amid surf and storms. What were its enemies? How it found food and reproduced its kind. What were its relations to the particular sea world in which it lived?
Rachel Carson, author and conservationist.